views and opinions expressed on this program are those of the program host, guests, and participants, and not necessarily those of KKRN Radio or Acorn Community Enterprises or the underwriters of this station. Welcome to KKRN Radio and Off the Shelf with Mary. I'm your host, Dr. Mary Mitchell, and I'll be sharing some of my favorite old and new nonfiction books about philosophy, spiritual psychology, business, science, and metaphysics, and some of these might just offer the knowledge that you've been looking for to enhance your life. I recently read a quote by J.D. Salinger, author of The Catcher in the Rye. He wrote, "What really knocks me out is a book that, when you're all done reading it, you wish the author that wrote it was a terrific friend of yours, and you could just call them up on the phone whenever you felt like it." Well, that's how I feel about the following two authors of our books that we're sharing today. The two books are about something challenging for many of us, punctuation. Now, don't turn it off yet. I think you're going to enjoy these really clever ways of bringing this education to you. In fact, the cover on the first book is very intriguing to many of us. It's a panda bear holding a gun, and it's entitled Eats, Shoots, and Leaves. The story is a panda walks into a cafe. He orders a sandwich, eats it, and then draws a gun and fires two shots in the air. "Why?" asks the confused waiter as the panda walks towards the exit. The panda produces a badly punctuated wildlife manual and tosses it over his shoulder. "I'm a panda," he says. "Look it up." The waiter turns to the relevant entry in the manual and, sure enough, finds a description of a panda. "A large black and white bear-like mammal, native to China, eats, shoots, and leaves." Yes, it's just one small comma after eats that makes all the difference. Other than the panda just eats, shoots, and leaves. Yet he eats, comma, shoots, and leaves. I got a big kick out of that. The book is written by Lynn Truss, who was a number one bestseller in England, and this book was published in 2003. The second book is How Not to Write, A Primer for the Grammatically Perplexed by Terence Denman, published in 2005. Both of these books are just delightful to read. So who is Lynn Truss? She's a writer and a journalist who started out as a literary editor. She's written three novels and numerous radio drama shows and spent 6 years as a television critic for the London Times, and she's a punctuation vigilante. She shares a story about a shopkeeper in Bristol, England, who deliberately struck ungrammatical signs in his window as a ruse to draw people into the shop. They would come in to complain, and then he would talk them into buying something. Can you imagine irate customers skewering him on his grammar? She comments that she'd love to write a play or a movie about this shopkeeper because he should be knighted. You know, so English. She quipped that she doesn't know how bad things are in America, but in the UK, she cannot emphasize it enough. Standards of punctuation are abysmal. She took some surveys and discovered to her horror that most British people truly do not know the apostrophe from their elbow. She has saved hundreds of horrific examples of idiotic signs. One of her favorites is, "Children drive slowly." Now, it's not meant to describe how slow infants are at the wheel, but by just adding a comma, it becomes children, comma, drive slowly, a kind sign that might even save lives. You know, punctuation has been defined many ways. Some grammarians use analogies like stitching, that punctuation is basting that holds the fabric of language in shape. Punctuation marks are the traffic signs of language. They tell us to slow down, notice this, take a detour, and stop. And punctuation is a courtesy used to help readers understand a story without stumbling through it. The practice of directing our writing using punctuation helps the reader to prevent awkward misunderstandings. You know, to be fair, many people couldn't punctuate their way out of a paper bag, but they're still interested in the way punctuation can alter the sense of a string of words. For instance, "I'm sorry, I'll read that again," versus "I'm sorry, comma, I'll read that again." The apostrophe is an interesting mark. It was first used in the English language in the 16th century. In Greek, apostrophe means turning away or omission, which is why it's used to indicate letters that have been dropped, and that is its only function. We use it without thinking, and it helps the flow of language. For instance, instead of saying it is, we use the apostrophe to say it's, I-T apostrophe S. You know, at some point in the 17th century, printers started to use an apostrophe before the S in singular possessive cases like the girl's dress. The girl, apostrophe S, dress. And then in the 18th century, printers started to put the apostrophe after plural possessives as well, such as the girls, like a gang of girls' dresses. The girls, apostrophe dresses. You know, the apostrophe also indicates the omission of numbers and dates, such as the summer of 68 is written apostrophe 68 to mean 1968. To those who care about pronunciation, a sentence such as, "Thank God it's Friday," without the apostrophe, I-T-S, it reads, "Thank God it is Friday." It brings up kind of a creepy feeling. So the rule is, the word I-T-S with apostrophe tells you it means it is or it has. If that's not what you want to use it for, then stick with the plain old I-T-S. One of Lynn's all-time favorite ad lines is, "Prudential dash, we're here to help you." The word "we're," W-E-R-E, was written with no apostrophe. And so when you read it, something feels really awkward, like, if they were there to help, where are they now? But Prudential, we apostrophe R-E, means we are here to help you. You know, Lynn continues to share many examples of the wrong use of apostrophe that will often just crack you up. She cautions that there are areas using apostrophe that are not so simple because over time our language styles change. She calls these acceptable exceptions. It's regarding proper names that end in S. For at an early age, Lynn knew that if she wanted to write something about Paul Jones, she did not write Jones with the second S, but Paul Jones apostrophe. Currently, modern names ending in S do get an extra S after the apostrophe, but oddly enough, not for words from biblical times. You wouldn't necessarily put an extra S on Achilles' heel or Moses' tablets. Lynn reiterates that if you want to replace the words "it is" or "it has," then the word "it apostrophe s" is what you need. You can replace the words "who is" or "who has." Then the word is "whose." If you want to replace the words "they are," then the word is "there," T-H-E-Y apostrophe R-E. And it's the same for using "you are" for "you are," "you apostrophe R-E for "you are." Are you confused yet? There is a moment called the conservation of apostrophes, which states that a balance exists in nature, so for every apostrophe omitted from an "it's," there is an extra one put on another "it's." Thus, the number of apostrophes in circulation remain constant, even if it means we have double the reason to bang our heads against a wall trying to understand this. The only illiteracy with apostrophes that stirs Lynn's sympathy is the greengrocer's variety. She writes that something rather troubling and unsatisfactory happens to words ending in vowels when you just plonk an S on the end. Take the word "banana." How can the word "banana" keep its punctuation when pluralized? Well, you could stick an apostrophe before the S, but then there's no apostrophe in potatoes. That's the plural of potato. You know, it's a societal thing, and just imagine how challenging this is to learn proper English. Lynn's book continues with chapters on commas, dashes, and it ends with the little-used punctuation mark, the hyphen. This is one I often question myself about. I didn't know that Woodrow Wilson said the hyphen was the most un-American thing in the world. Churchill said hyphens were a blemish to be avoided wherever possible. But there's a problem about getting rid of the hyphen. if it's not used in the words extramarital sex, then it's extramarital sex. These phrases kind of cry out for hyphens. Extra hyphen marital sex. Okay, got it. The word hyphen comes from Greek to help determine spatial relationships. It means into one or together. It joins words and words with prefixes to help our understanding, while it keeps certain other words intentionally apart. In this way, the pickled herring merchant can hold his head up high, since he would not be written about as the pickled hyphen herring merchant. Oh my. Many words require hyphens to avoid ambiguity, such as reformed. Hyphenated, a reformed rock band is quite different from a reformed one. It's still necessary to use hyphens when spelling out numbers such as 32. And it's applied when a noun phrase such as stainless steel is used to qualify another noun. It's hyphenated as stainless hyphen steel, stainless steel kitchen. One of the main uses of the hyphen is to indicate that a word is unfinished and it continues on the next line. Now, this assumes you know where to split the word. Wasn't that second or third grade? I don't remember. Some dictionaries say the hyphen is headed for extinction, but then how would we write the game kicked off at 3? Could kicked off really be one word? And then there's the dash, derived from the Middle English verb dashen. It means to hurl or to break. The dash creates drama. And then there's the ellipses, the three dots, dot, dot, dot. And they're often used to indicate words missing from a quote. And it also is used to trail off a sentence in an intriguing manner. Dot, dot, dot. So much to think about. KKRN is a community radio station supported by listeners and a team of volunteers who keep everything organized and running well. You're invited to support this amazing group by sending a donation to KKRN, P.O. Box 188, Round Mountain, California, 96805, or look for the donate button on the website. We also love donations of cars, trucks, boats, or motorcycles through careasy.org. And if you have any questions, give us a call, 1-855-500-7433. The second book is How Not to Write by Terence Denman. So who is Terence Denman? He's a Cambridge-educated instructor with the UK-based Plain English campaign. It's an international organization that fights for the use of crystal clear language in business and government communication. He has a really breezy way of writing, so it's very entertaining to read this book. He acknowledges that grammar has a reputation for being as interesting as watching paint dry. He finds most business writing mediocre or worse, where one frequently has to read something more than once to get the meaning. And often, the real point in any business writing could be made with a lot fewer words. He believes that business writing is the most neglected skill and that businesses don't teach it compared with other building exercises and healthy workshops and safety workshops. In this fast-paced workplace, emails fly at lightning speed, so precision and brevity are essential for good communication. But all too often, we let spell checkers do the dirty work, because many of us have forgotten the simple grammar rules we learned in school. So in his book, How Not to Write, Denman explores the top 10 grammar myths and the 10 grammar rules to live and work by. He reviews how to position propositions, how to chop off unwanted words, how to root out passivity, to eliminate extra adjectives, and punctuate with impunity. First, Denman believes in the four C's. Number one, business writing must be correct. It gives the reader correct information and grammar and spelling and punctuation. Poor grammar does not impress a reader, and it makes our writing more difficult to understand. Second, good business writing is clear. so clear that the reader only has to read it once to understand the meaning. Although clarity is in the eye of the beholder, it's important to step outside our writing and look at it from the reader's point of view. Would they have to have prior knowledge to understand what's being said in our memo? Next, good business writing is concise, a challenge because there is too much wordiness in business communications these days. Many offices don't give their employees red pens to cross through their writing before they send it out, and it wastes a reader's time, and it's basically rude. Do you remember years ago that at some point there was going to be a paperless office? Well, today there's more paper around than ever. While we wait for a paperless office, he says we should be doing our best to make sure that we're not unnecessarily contributing to the ocean of paper that surrounds us. Voltaire once wrote to a friend, and his letter said, "I'm sorry this is a long letter. I didn't have time to write you a short one," meaning that he did not have time to reread and edit what he wrote. So next, good business is writing conversationally. Too much office writing gets tangled up by moving far away from our everyday words that we use when we're talking with someone. It's a good idea to listen to anything we've written and ask ourselves whether we would have really used the same words when speaking face to face. He's not saying to write as you speak, because we don't always use proper grammar anyway, but to listen to how the reader hears our words. Throughout this book, he gives examples of how not to write by quoting some of the Plain English Campaign's annual Golden Bull Award. You can just imagine. And they're all genuine, though you may find that difficult to believe. But his grammar tip number one, he introduces us to the period. It would always be there when you need it, and you will, because good writers use the period more than any other punctuation. Why is that? Well, words are the basic building blocks of writing, but words don't make sense until we form them into sentences. We all think we know what a sentence is. You might think a sentence is what comes between two periods, but the best way to define a sentence is to say that it contains an idea, or many ideas, if the sentence is long. But when it's too long, a sentence tends to fall apart grammatically and overburdens the reader with too much information all at once. In a few of the classes that I teach, we come across very long sentences that are tiresome to read. Ralph Waldo Emerson often goes on and on and on. Judge Thomas Troward can make a whole paragraph out of one sentence to convey his ideas. And so as a learning tool, we break the sentence down to separate the ideas. And then I often hear students' appreciation when they go, "Oh, now I get it." Denman recommends that writers aim for an average of 18 words per sentence. And don't try to make all sentences 18 words long, because that is craziness for the reader. But closely look at any sentence that has more than 25 words and break it apart. There just may be more than one idea in a sentence that long. Either way, too many long sentences or too many short sentences make the reading annoying and boring. If you spot a long sentence that you've written, take a look at any comma or semicolons in that sentence, and often you can change the comma to a period. Next, look for any connecting words such as and, but, or because. These connecting words in a short sentence can be left alone, but if you spot connecting words in a long sentence, look for places to add periods. You might have been moving on to a new idea that really needs to stand on its own. Another option for long sentences is turning them into a bulleted list. All of these ideas benefit the reader, who will be very glad to understand your points easily. Here is one of these award-winning Golden Bull business writings. Our current top management structure is too complex and confusing and leads to a loss of manufacturing efficiency because it takes a long time to make a decision and even longer to implement it at the factory floor. And this also means that we cannot respond to improvements in technology and design fast enough. Wow. Now, the fun part about this book is Denman gives sample rewrites so you can understand how to break down these very long sentences. Another grammar tip is to question whether we're being too passive in our business writing. One of the things he cautions is that a paragraph with several passive words requires more words if we're going to get the point to the reader that the reader has to take action. Too many passive words create ambiguity. An active sentence presents information in a logical order, such as who is doing it and what they're doing and what the outcome is expected to be. And an active voice is more human. It sounds like you're connecting with a person. Have you noticed that there's not a lot of human action in a company's instructions on how to assemble something? Nor is there much compassion as I try to read diagrams and explanations on a different page in this. When I'm about to scream, it finally makes sense. But boy, it takes me through the ringer to get there at times. Now, adjectives. They're used to describe things, and they can be a lot of fun. And I often Google synonyms to find even better ones. Positive adjectives that we would like others to use in describing things to us. Maybe we're attractive, intelligent, talented, loyal. Things that we are sure our friends say about us every day. Well, then there's those other words like plain, stupid, clumsy, fickle. All of these are adjectives that describe nouns also. Adjectives can also be qualities, shapes, and colors. And I'm sure you'll recognize these. The old man, the blue sky, the loud noise. Old, blue, and loud are pretty nice adjectives. But the author cautions, too many adjectives are pointless and they add to the gobbledygook in bad writing. In this case, Denman describes the adjective as too often a parasite sucking the life out of the language. We misuse adjectives when the adjective is doing nothing that the noun couldn't do on its own, such as a general consensus, when just the word consensus is already a general agreement. A component part, when either word can be used separately. A terrible disaster, but are there non-terrible disasters? Our future plans, but how can you plan for anything but the future? A safe haven, but is there a dangerous haven? A new innovation, but an innovation is already new. Oh, these crack me up. A common question for me is when to use a comma and when not to. Now, Denman says that we use a comma to show a pause in a phrase. And we can do this when the next word is and. So when in doubt, say the sentence out loud so you can get a sense where there's a need for a pause. That is another bridge crossed for me. The English language has more words than any other, but it lacks one very useful word. English does not have a common gender, third-person, singular pronoun. For an example, a good writer always checks their spelling. Now, writer is singular, but their, T-H-E-I-R, is technically plural. I might disagree with that, but I'm not writing the book. It might be written any one of these ways. Good writers always check their spelling, or a good writer always checks his spelling, or a good writer always checks his or her spelling. Now, the first sentence does not seem as precise as the original. The second is sexist, assuming the writer is a male. And third, it's just downright clumsy. So you probably see what Denman means, that English has no common gender, third person, singular pronoun. He expects within a few years that everyone will accept the plural they, their, or them as correct singular words as well as plural. For example, if a customer writes in to complain, we must reply to them within 7 days. Another one, any student applying for a grant must send in their form by June 21st. So you get away from that clumsy his, her. Denman describes a terrible disease that is stalking our land. the disease is synonymitis. Doctors disagree about the origin of the disease, but they think it's probably caused by too much exposure to a thesaurus. A thesaurus presents synonyms, words that mean the same or roughly the same as the word you're trying to look up. He advises using the thesaurus with caution. It's from a Greek word, treasure store. It is full of treasures of the English language, but spend its treasures wisely. Don't use a $5 word when a 50-cent word will do. Find the best and simplest word that will do the job effectively and stick with it. You know, changing a word just to find a different word for variety often damages the writing. Teachers might give you extra marks for using different words as they try to get you to build up your own vocabulary, but in the real world, taking readers for a little trip through a thesaurus is not good style. For instance, most people understand the word begin, but when we add initiate, instigate, or inaugurate instead, it could cause problems. And many times a few synonyms don't match very well. But then no one is trying to deprive you of your right to use any word as long as you're convinced it's the best word available. The author was listening to a university radio station's weather report and was delighted to get some expert information that he had already assumed that the heavy rain was to blame for local flooding. But according to the station's expert, the real cause was repeated rain precipitation events. Exasperated, Denham wondered if anyone would want to hear Gene Kelly belting out the song, singing in the repeated rain precipitation event. No, of course. So I hope you've enjoyed hearing about the wide variety of words used in the English language by Lynn Truss and Terrence Denman, and how important it is to be clear and concise in your communication every day, especially in the workplace. You know, use this information for good in your life, and for those you don't like, use it for their good anyway. And so now I am going to let you enjoy the music for this show, which is from an acoustical guitar by the Lemming Shepherds called Symphony for the Senses. And it comes with even a full-color booklet on their many adventures. So until next week, may peace be with you.